No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, a public affair. I am Esti Dinur. And we're waiting for some music before we introduce our guest to you today. Our guest is Derek Jensen. He's an author of about 20 books, an environmental activist living in the Pacific Northwest. He was named one of Adney Reader's 50 visionaries who are changing the world. And hello, Derek. Thanks for joining us today.
Having me.
Let's hear a little bit of music and get to our discussion. And these sounds were provided to us courtesy of Rebecca Campbell, who recorded them at a meeting earlier this week in Milwaukee, organized by the Bad River Band, to discuss the mine that the multinational Gogebic Taconite wants to build on near their lands in the Pinoki range, and that our illustrious governor Scott Walker, a paragon of the extreme capitalist right in this country, is trying to pass a bill to support that mine. How familiar does that sound, Derek?
It's a little bit familiar. I did a talk up in that region a couple years ago, and a lot of the local people were talking about how terrible that mine was. And also, I used to do a monthly interview on WOJB, mm-hmm. and we often talked about that mine. So it's not a local issue to me, but for an issue that is halfway across the continent, I do know a little bit about it.
Yeah, what I meant really is just how familiar is that theme of powerful and very rich people / corporations going into the areas that are owned by, to the degree that anything is owned by anybody, but that are on or right next to the areas where indigenous people live, or poor people live for that matter, or both, and forcing extractive industries at the risk of these people who live there.
Well, you've just told the entire story of civilization. That's the story of this culture that goes back for thousands of years. It's what it's based on. This is a story of empire, where empires require colonies in order to continue. I was doing an interview maybe six months ago with some guy from Nature Online, which really is not about nature at all, but rather about science and exploitation. It's pretty dreadful. Anyway, he at one point he was insisting that it is possible to have this sort of culture we have, and an industrial society, without having where everybody makes all their decisions willingly, with no exploitation of humans. And I said, "Wow, I don't agree." And he said, "Well, yeah, that's so great. You disagree. So what?" And I said, "Okay, you have the city. So where do you get your metal for buses and your metal for bicycles, whatever?" and a car, it doesn't matter. And he said, well, you get it from mind. I said, okay, we have a problem right there. And we talked about minds, and he said, well, let's say that you pay everybody so much money that they're willing to spend their lives underground, which is problematical right there. I mean, mines were among the first places that you ever had slaves, because you either have to pay people an awful lot of money to go underground and spend their lives there, or you have to enslave them, or you find ways. What the dominant culture does is find ways to make them dependent upon you otherwise, but leave that aside. So he agreed that mines are inherently toxic. And I said, okay, so great. You have let's say you have people who've lived along this river next to the mine for 100,000 years or 10,000 years, long time, doesn't matter. And this is their home. And he said, well, you pay them to leave. I said, well, they don't want to leave. Their ancestors live there. They live there. And he said, well, you vote with everybody in the city, and if there's only 1,000 of them and there's 1,000,000 of you, you just outvote them and then you drive them off. I said, really? So basically, just in, you know, three sentences, we've gone from this association where everybody does things voluntarily to the story of empire. I mean, that is the story of empire. Is cities require raw materials from the countryside, and when people in the countryside don't want to give them, the powerful people will take them. And that's the story of the last several thousand years. That's the story of the merger of the planet. It's happening everywhere. It doesn't matter. My niece was just here she lives in Colombia, and she's married to a very, very nice guy who is Chinese, and he works for a Chinese oil corporation, helping to put oil rigs into the Amazon. And he's a wonderful guy personally, but that doesn't alter the fact that he's committing genocide and ecocide. And that's part and parcel of how the economy works. You know, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about northern Alaska or the Dinku River or the Mekong Delta. It doesn't matter. It's the same story. I've got a friend in India who is talking. In fact, I just got a note from somebody else in India somebody I don't know, who is requesting an organization with which I'm associated, Deep Kune Resistance, requesting their assistance for help. They have 200 villages in India that are being taken over by transnational mining corporations and, you know, to be gutted for mines. This is the story of the culture. Once again, I'll say one more thing and then I'll shut up. I remember when I was first becoming an activist 23, 24, 25 years ago, that this friend of mine and the guy who really got me into activism, we were having dinner one night, and we sat down at, and we're obviously sitting in a restaurant, and he takes a napkin, and he draws a small circle, and he says, this is a city. And then he draws a larger circle around it, and he said, this is the countryside. The city requires resources from the countryside, and no matter what the people who live in the countryside want, they can sometimes be convinced to give up their resources, especially if they're already colonized. But traditional people living out there do not want to give up their resources, which means empire requires conquest. Cities require conquest. This is once again the story of cities. So you started with a great question.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, of course, everything that you said, you brought 10 more questions. But I want to tell you that not long ago, I was in an airport going through the TSA dreadful line, and a very nice man struck a conversation with me, a Scottish man, was very nice talking to him, and then I asked him where he was going. He was going to Kazakhstan because he is a supervisor on oil rigs, and BP has oil rigs there, and he was going to work on that. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yes. And I said, wow, you're working for BP. And he said, oh, yeah, but they're really good with their safety. And I said, hey, what about Deepwater Horizon? It was just really not long ago. And he said, oh, that, yeah.
That little thing.
Found another line to stand at. So here we have you know a very nice man who does that, and I met a very nice man who does that. What does that tell us, and what can we do about it?
Well, one of the things it tells us is that the problems are systematic and the problems are functional. And it also tells us, once again, the truth of a great line by Upton Sinclair, which is, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, we can take away the sexism in the line and also make it more generic, which is, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement and privilege depends on them not understanding it. And that's, you know, another thing that my friend John Osborne, the guy who wrote the thing on the piece of paper years ago, another thing he said to me that I've quoted a bazillion times is, a lot of environmental activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. And the reason is because if you ask, why is this land being destroyed, then, you know, it leads you to start questioning some things about the economic system. And then that leads you also to ask, so why is land being destroyed everywhere? And then that leads you to ask, why do people live in such a way that the choice is between jobs versus the land where you live? And that leads you to ask, how can anybody be so stupid as to have an extractive economy? And because an extractive economy cannot be sustainable. And that then leads you to ask, how is it that, for example, all of the so-called solutions to global warming that are put forward in the mainstream, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they all take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with the physical reality, because without a real world, you don't have life. You don't have any social system whatsoever. It's just like somebody forwarded me this article recently written by Paul Ehrlich, and the article was, given, the title was something to the effect of, you know, given what civilization is doing to the planet, can civilization be saved? And I wrote back to the guy and said, why would we want to? I mean, it's killing the planet. And the point is that, you know, what my friend said was true. So many frontline activists have gone through this process of wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundation of Western civilization. But I keep asking myself, how is it that so many people who are so-called members of the, you know, environmental intelligentsia, you know, the sort of public spokespeople, how is it that they stopped their questioning at some point? And, you know, it was so interesting to me. An Inconvenient Truth was, you know, really good for exposing, you know, sort of bringing attention to global warming. But all of the solutions are personal, and all of the solutions don't look at corporations. I mean, it's all about inflating your tires, you know? And it's just manifestly ridiculous. If every person in the United States did everything that Al Gore suggested in the movie, which is not going to happen, not everybody's going to do it, but if everybody did all of that, it would have reduced carbon emissions by 18%. But since he didn't question, and, you know, the scientific consensus needs to be reduced by 80%, so A, it's insufficient, but B, he didn't question a global growth economy. And if you don't question a global growth economy, I mean, all of that would disappear in a few years as the economy continued to grow. And it's insane to think you can have an infinite growth on a finite planet of an economy. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem, I mean, one of the things about, you know, my niece's husband being a really nice guy, a genuinely nice guy, and this guy you met at the airport being a genuinely nice guy, one of the things about that is that the problems, you know, one of my favorite lines from one of my books was from Culture and Make-Believe, and the book was supposed to be about hate groups, supposed to be a five-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups, how it's supposed to start. And the first question I asked was, I went to a KKK website, and the KKK said, well, we're not a hate group, we're a love group because we love whites. I was thinking, well, okay, so either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, you can't trust rhetoric. Well, if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? And then I started thinking, okay, if you want to look at the largest racist segregationist organization in the United States, it would be the U.S. judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK could only dream of.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, So what does this mean? And so I started thinking more and more, and my favorite line in the whole book is I said that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics or religion or the way things are. And so my point is that this culture, this culture's hatred of nature is so deep and so fully enshrined that it's turned it into an economic system where people are systematically rewarded for doing the wrong thing. Can I say one more thing about this?
Sure, yeah. It's your hour, Derek.
Okay. Ruth Benedict, the anthropologist, asked a really important question, which is, she was studying various indigenous peoples around the world, and she asked, why is it that some cultures are fundamentally good, she said, and some cultures are fundamentally bad? Why is it that women are treated very well in some cultures and women are treated horribly in some other cultures? And why is it that children are treated well in some cultures? And why is it that in some cultures people are generally pretty happy and there's a lot of cooperation? And why is it in some others that there's a lot of competition and people are at each other's throats? And what she found, and she said, you know, it's not race. She tried all sorts of things, race, house size, abundance of wildlife, all sorts of stuff, and it was none of that. What it was a very simple thing, which is what she found is that humans are both selfish and social. And, you know, we hear all this nonsense from Richard Dawkins about selfish genes control us, and that's really the sort of the controlling meme of this culture, which is just dreadful. And then other people like to think, oh, humans are all groovy and wonderful, and we get along really well, which also isn't necessarily true. What she found is that the cultures that were really good and people were generally happy and were not destructive cultures, they had one simple rule, which is they made it so selfishness and altruism were identical by socially rewarding the behavior that benefited the group as a whole and socially disallowing the behavior that benefited individuals at the expense of the group.
Huh.
So it's really simple, and it all came down to how the culture handled wealth. That if it handled wealth through what she called a funnel system, whereby wealth was constantly funneled from the rich to the poor, then everybody is secure because you don't have to worry about where your food comes from. On the other hand, if it handled it through what she called a funnel system, whereby wealth is constantly funneled from the poor to the rich, then everybody is in constant competition for those, I hate the word resources, but we'll use it for shorthand here, for those resources, for the food, for whatever. And so what would happen is, let's say that you and I are living in a community, and the community, you know, it's the Talawa on whose land I live. The Talawa have lived here for 10,000 years, and they didn't destroy the place. The dominant culture has been here for 180, and the place is trashed because of that. But let's say that we're both in that community, and I might go get some salmon, and then I come back, and I don't sell the salmon to everybody. I give the salmon away, and everybody goes, wow, Derek, you're so great. You gave us so much salmon. And I get socially rewarded. I receive social points for giving the salmon away, and I can give all the salmon away because I know tomorrow you're going to go gathering, and you're going to get a whole bunch of huckleberries, and you're going to bring those back, and then we're all going to say, oh, my gosh, you are so great, and you will be rewarded for that. And that's how it works in a healthy, functioning family. I mean, nobody hoards. Nobody says, you know, mother doesn't say, Junior, could you hand over the potatoes? And Junior says, I'll sell them to you for $5. You know, that's not how it works within a healthy, functioning family. But we have an entire culture that's based on stealing from indigenous people, stealing from the natural world, stealing from communities of fish in the ocean, and not giving anything in return, and then selling that and acquiring. This culture is based on that private acquisition. What this culture rewards is that behavior, is that community-destroying behavior, and in that environmentally-destroying behavior. And so it's basically just behavior modification 101. You're going to get the behavior that you reward. And what this culture socially rewards is environmentally-destructive behavior.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Derek Jensen. He's the author of many books, environmental activist living in the North Pacific Northwest, was declared by ATNI Readers one of the 50 visionaries who are changing your world. If you want to join the conversation and haven't called in the past 7 days, you are welcome to call 256-2001 or 1-866-899-WORT. Derek, before I ask you the next question, I just would like to ask you to define the notion of civilization, because you used that term at least twice so far. And I think what you mean is Western civilization rather than civilization as a general term. Am I correct, or how do you define that word?
No, I mean civilization, because Western civilization is not the only civilization that's arisen, and they've all been destructive. You get Chinese civilizations going back about the same amount of time, and you know, there used to be elephants in China, and they were destroyed by civilization. The Aztecs were a civilization, and civilization I define really rigorously as, you know, I don't like the dictionary definition, which is just scarily narcissistic. And the dictionary definition, the first definition is something like, you know, the best way to live. It's like, oh gosh, we are living in that way, and we define as the best way to live. What a surprise.
What dictionary is that?
Oh, it's just the regular old everyday, like Webster's.
Really?
If you look up civilization, that's one of the ones you find. Another one defines it as identical to culture, which, of course, is crazy, too.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the one that really works. And this one is in a lot of dictionaries, too. And it works linguistically, anyway, and also historically, which is civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's actually the root of it. Civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means state or city. So I define a civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of a city. But that's nice, Jack, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources, which means the Talawa, once again, on whose land I now live, and who are living here essentially forever, they weren't civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages or camps or whatever. And the point is, that they didn't require the importation of resources. They lived with what the land gave willingly. Two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources, with require being the key word. But, of course, the people here traded with other people, but they didn't trade for necessities. They just ate the salmon, they ate the huckleberries, more salmon, more salmon, more salmon, and more salmon, elk, sea mammals, etc. They ate what the land gave willingly for 10,000 years at least, 12,000 actually at least. So two things happen as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of life can never be sustainable, because if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you're going to denude an ever larger area. You're doing drawdown, which is not sustainable. The other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. And the reason it must be based on violence is because if you require the importation of resources, it means that if the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for this resource, they'll take it. Because if you require it, you know, you're gonna have it, which means we could all become perfectly enlightened, and the United States would still need a huge military, because how else are they going to get the access to the oil that they need to run the economy? They require oil to run the economy. They're going to take it, which is what we see time and again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a systematic functional problem. Once you commit yourself to a way of life that is characterized by drawing down the resources of where you live, by destroying the land base of where you live, then two things happen. One is that you have to conquer other people because you've destroyed your own land base, and the other is you have a competitive advantage over the others because you are turning the raw materials of land and trees, et cetera, into war machines to conquer. That's what happened to, and this is a pattern that goes way back. I'm gonna name a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. You know, they say that the ability to recognize patterns is one sign of intelligence. So here it is. But when you think of Iraq as the first thing you think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's what Iraq was prior to the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. He did it to build great cities. And then the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna, and the Near East was heavily forested. There, you know, there are the wonderful cedars of Lebanon that we read about in the Bible, and
right.
You know, of course, they still have one on their flag. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. All the forests of North Africa went to build the Egyptian and Phoenician navies, and they made really powerful navies that they could conquer other people with. And this is a pattern we see, you know, up until today. But there aren't any more frontiers. You know, there's no more hills to go over to find new big batches of trees. This is why they're doing all this dreadful stuff like fracking. I mean, it's
right.
Finally coming home. They're, for crying out loud, they're poisoning their own water supply now, not just poisoning other people's water supplies. This is we're in the final stages of this blowout.
Yeah. Well, goodness. Again, everything you say, first of all, it's fascinating, but it also brings so many more questions. And we'll get to some of
which
them.
Which was my friend's point. You know, you start the questions, and then the key is to just keep asking the question. To pretend you're 4 years old and keep going. It was like when my niece was here; she had a 4-year-old daughter, and we were taking a walk through the forest. And at one point, the daughter was saying, "We walked by a stream," and the daughter said, "So, where does water come from?"
Mm.
And my niece said, "Well, it rains," and then, where does the rain come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well. It evaporates from the ocean. Where does the water come from in the ocean? Well, it goes to stream. And it was great. My niece did a great job of describing the hydrologic cycle. And we need to not stop asking those questions. We need to start asking, why did there used to be whales in the Mediterranean and there aren't now? You know, why are they poisoning their own water supply? Why are they poisoning other? It's the question you asked. Why are they putting in a mine there? That leads us ineluctably to here.
Yeah. Well, let's open the phones and invite our listeners to join us, unless they have called in the past 7 days. And we have two callers for you. At this point, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question on what is it that you feel is the key, the first milestone into creating a change in our society, into creating a more established environmental economy?
Thank you. Derek.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And I, as I do on a lot of things, I defer here to a lot of the indigenous peoples with whom I've spoken over the years. And I think the first and most important thing for us to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, to start to recognize that this culture is not good. It's like, you know, I keep going back to that friend of mine, John Osborne, with the piece of paper. He's also a doctor, and he always says the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And like I mentioned in that paper by Paul Ehrlich, can civilization be saved? It's the wrong question. The right question is, can coral reefs be saved, or can the oceans be saved, or can tigers be saved, can prairie dogs be saved, can buffalo be saved? And the first and most important thing we have to do is to change our loyalty from the system that doesn't serve us well. There's a great line by Frederick Winslow Taylor. He was the guy who sort of developed the process of Taylorization, which is what is meant by that. Like when you go to McDonald's, or if somebody goes to McDonald's, if you go to McDonald's, you'll see that, you know, one person is flipping burgers all day, another person is wrapping burgers all day, another person is standing at the cash register. He really helped develop that specialization process. And one of the things he said that just gave me chills is, once again, excuse the sexism, his language, not mine, in the past, the man was first, in the future, the system shall be first. So I think one of the first things we have to do is to break our loyalty with the system, break our identity with the system, and to switch our loyalty to the land where we live and switch our loyalty to a local community and switch our loyalty to the victims of this culture. We need to not identify with the oppressors, but instead identify with the victims and identify with the land where we live. I think that that's absolutely crucial and the first step. Once you do that, everything else starts to fall into place. And a great example of how deeply we identify with the culture is, you know, people will say we when they're talking about the actions of corporations, the U.S. government. We are deforesting the planet. Sorry, I'm not deforesting the planet. Boise Cascade, Weyerhaeuser, et al. Are destroying the planet. we don't need to identify with them. Or another example is a friend of mine will call up and say, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? I'm like, mm-hmm. We're in Afghanistan? Oh, my gosh, I thought we're in Northern California. So my friend's like, how much longer do you think we're going to have troops in Afghanistan? It's like, I got troops? Holy crap, will they do what I tell them? So my friend's like, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. I did this to my mom the other day. It's pretty funny. My mom said, you know, it's just so terrible that we torture. I said, Mom, you torture? That's horrible. And my mom said, I'm 80 years old. Don't do this to me. I'm your mother.
She's right, by the way.
What?
She's right in a way, you know.
Well, I know. But the point is that we do this. My point is that if aliens came down from outer space and they were changing the climate, they were putting carcinogens into every mother's breast milk, and they were vacuuming the oceans and deforesting the planet, destroying the Great Plains everywhere. If there used to be 60 million bison and the aliens killed them all for their tongues or for their, or just to leave them lying on the plains until there's only, what, at one point there was 100 and some left?
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, there's what, 1,400 pure blooded bison or something, and they still shoot them outside Yellowstone. If the aliens were doing this, we would freak out. We would know what to do. But because we are so deeply immersed in this culture, we don't recognize. I mean, for crying out loud, I had this friend years ago who's really, really smart. He's a great guy, and he works for Lawrence Livermore Labs. You know, here we go with nice mm-hmm. people doing terrible things.
Yes.
And maybe, oh gosh, 15, 18 years ago, his wife died of brain cancer. And at the time, he said to me, wow, it's just such a strange coincidence that so many people I know at work, she also worked there, so many people I know at work are dying of cancer.
Hmm.
And this is at Lawrence Livermore Labs, where they work with radioactive materials. And
right.
He's a very, very smart guy, and he couldn't see this, even though it killed his own wife.
Huh.
And that's how deeply our identification is with this culture, that we will have those. At talks, I ask, how many people have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 70% of the people usually say yes. And, of course, cancer is caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. And we still don't question the system when it's killing the people we love. And that's nuts. That's why, you know, this little point about, oh, we torture, whatever. You know, I'm just a sort of a semi-humorous, at least it's funny for me. My mom didn't think it was so funny. Way to get at this. But the point is that what I'm trying to do, I think the first step to do is to break the identification with the system, to recognize that the government is a government of occupation. What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, facilitates resource extraction, and maximizes production. That's what it does. That's what governments of occupation have always done. And, of course, all my American Indian friends are saying, the United States is a government of occupation. What took you so long to figure this one out?
Mm-hmm.
But we need to break that identification. I'm not saying we shouldn't participate. I'm saying we should make our decisions based upon that switch in loyalty. And what we should do is we should find what we love and then defend that which we love. You know, I have a hard time, he didn't really ask this, but I have a hard time telling people what to do because I don't know people. I have a really good friend who used to run a battered women's program for the state of New York, and she's so wonderful. She's relentless. She asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? I swear, you get in a taxi cab with a woman, she says, can you please take me to Central Park? And by the way, what's it going to take for men to stop beating on women? Do not get on the subway with this woman. It's insane. It's wonderful. I mean, she's asked every man on the subway. I swear, every guy she sees. So the point is that she doesn't care about salmon, and I would never say to her, you know, you need to stop doing what you're doing and protect salmon. Because that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. And so her issue is she wants men to stop beating on women. And, you know, there's great work to be done there. On the other hand, I know people who are desperately in love with prairie dogs, and they will do whatever it takes to defend prairie dogs. And they will work. They will spend all their lives working just to help prairie dogs. I know people who have devoted their life to penguins, to bison, and on, you know. So that's the thing is find something that's wrong and then set out to fix it. You know, the big distinction is not between the people who believe in militant resistance and the people who don't believe in militant resistance. The big difference is between the people who do something and the people who do nothing. And I want to tell one more story about this, which is the way I got started in activism, which is the smartest thing I ever did. I was in my mid-20s, And I realized that I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. And, you know, I wasn't covering the ecological or social costs of gas. So every time I was going to fill a tank, I was going to, for every dollar I spent on gas, I was going to give a dollar to a local environmental organization, never a national organization, always a local one. And but I didn't have any money. So if I spent $10 on gas, I would give $10 to a local environmental organization. But I didn't have any money. And so I started paying myself $5 an hour to do activism. So at that point, it would cost $10 to fill your tank with gas. And at that point, I drove enough that I would fill a tank of gas once a week. So every week, I would do two hours of activism. And it, because the problems are so big, where do you start? And it's so easy to get paralyzed. But I can't stop all the problems, so I didn't do anything until I started doing this. I can do 2 hours a week. So then I would, you know, attend an anti-fur demo, or I went to a anti-circus demo, and you know, I realized that demos are kind of a waste of time, but they were a really good sort of gateway for me to get into it. And I started writing letters to the editor, and then soon enough I was having so much fun doing the activism, I stopped keeping track.
Mm-hmm.
And one more thing about this, which is that I didn't let my ignorance stop me. I just knew that circuses are bad. I didn't know why. And so there was going to be a circus in town. I went down. They provided the sign for me. I stood there holding a sign, circuses are bad. And I remember some guy came up to me and said, he was really mad. He said, why do you say circuses are so bad? And I said, I don't know. Ask the guy next to me, you know? It's like I wasn't going to say anything that was wrong, but on the other hand, I didn't let the fact, we can all find a million excuses not to do anything, and none of the excuses are good enough, you know? It's like, just start doing something, and then start asking the questions, and then just let them keep building from there. And so back to Guy's original question, the first thing we need to do is break our loyalty to the system and begin to identify with our local communities, which explicitly and 100% includes the land and includes other victims of this culture. We need to identify with women. We need to make our allegiance to women absolute. We need to make our allegiance to, as a white person, need to make our allegiance to victims of white pattern violence and all sorts of racism. We need to make our identity with those victims absolute too.
Mm-hmm. And we have more callers for you, so let's just get back to the phones right away. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Caller.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hey, great show. You had said something earlier about frontiers, I think, in relation to Egypt. It seems to me historically that when kind of an extensive exploitation, if it reaches its limit, it kind of becomes intensive. Maybe with fracking, or they're always talking about Alaska as well. Do you think that we've reached some kind of limit in that sense?
Okay, another good question.
Wait, stand on the line for a second. Can you explain just a little bit more? I think I understand, but I want to be clear.
Whereas trying to cut our energy dependence by trying to come up with it here, I suppose. But I guess it would be with anything else as well.
I think, caller, let me see if I understand you correctly. I think what you're saying is that, for example, it's not really easy to extract oil anymore, so what we're doing instead is, not we, I'm sorry, Derek, what they are doing, that's a really good advice, by the way, thanks. What they are doing instead is, staying here in the United States and coming up with new ways of doing it, such as fracking, such as going to Alaska. And it's true, I believe, that fracking is more intensive in more intensive of a method of extracting oil than the relatively easy extracting it from huge fields that have oil, which hardly exist anymore.
It may be easier to get it here, but I was wondering if you thought that is just the logical. That they have to do that now.
Yeah, you know, when I was in college, I was a I was a high jumper, and I had 1 year of eligibility left when I finished my degree, and so I went to graduate school for 1 year, and it was in mineral economics from the Colorado School of Mines. And I did the coursework, but not the thesis. I bailed out at the end. And the one thing I remember from the mineral economics classes is that you always extract the easy stuff first. You know, there. Now you have the benefits of my entire class study there. Okay, so the point is you always extract the easy stuff first. You take the oil that you can scoop up with your hands. You know, when they first found oil, they could basically just scoop it up from seeps. And then they had to drill, and then they had to drill deeper, and then they had to drill in more difficult places. This is all just a logical extension. They've run out of the easy stuff. And so that's one reason that they are. The logical next extension, if they value the system over their own lives, is to frack their own water supplies. And to frack underneath even their own homes and not just other people's homes. So, yeah, it's a logical extension of if you value the system over even your own life, you know, recognizing, of course, that the rich people are, for the most part, insulated from the effects of their actions. They can always buy water, you know, for a little bit longer. But, yeah, it's the same thing. We see the same thing with fish. You know, it used to be, I mean, I don't actually know all the names, but it ends up that a lot of the fish that people are eating now are not actually the fish they call it because they've already fished out that species. And so now I'm totally making up the specific name here, but I know that the process is what happens. You know, what is now called snapper is not actually snapper. I could be wrong with that particular fish, but they do this with a lot of them because they've destroyed that stock. So they go to fish that nobody ate in the world before because they didn't taste nearly as good, and now they're really forced to. So this is another way. When I mentioned the frontier line, another thing I was thinking, right when I said that, is that that's why they're also moving into patent and exploit various parts of genetic materials. Is that's just they always have to have frontiers to keep exploiting. And one of the frontiers is the micro frontier there. And there's, you know, that not only was the technology not available to do that a long time ago, but also they didn't need to. But they're pushing this to, you know, the ends of the earth literally now.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, are you on the air? Caller.
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, me.
It is you. Go ahead.
Okay, so I just wanted to say that we're having a benefit for the Bad River Tribe on January 26th, and this is a really awesome discussion, and I am just really excited to hear Derek's thoughts. And this is Thistle, and I just wanted to give a shout-out, and I agree with everything you're saying, and we're going to have bands and food, lots of local businesses are supporting the benefit on the 26th. It's going to be at the Wilmar Center. We're starting at 6 p.m. with a wild rice dinner. And then we're going to have an opening dance by Miranda Moon. And then we're going to have the Solidarity Singers come up and do some anti-mining songs that we can all sing along to. And then we've got the Beat Road Blues Band, my band, and then finally Tani DePate and the Afro-Funk All-Stars. And so I just wanted to put that out there and thank Derek so much.
Well, Thistle, before you go, can you tell us also about what's happening that day at the same place at Wilma at 3 p.m. and there's a rally, too, I believe, at noon?
Yeah, the January 26th is going to be quite a day in Madison. There's a rally at noon to demonstrate to the politicians and the powers that be that the people in Wisconsin want clean water and we don't want mining up north. Members of the Bad River Tribe are going to speak at the rally. And then fortuitously and coincidentally, the Warrior Up Resistance Tour is coming through town, and they're also going to be at the Wilmar Center.
At 3 that day.
And they'll be performing indigenous hip hop and speaking about deep green resistance and basically engaging people and encouraging people to become more involved and more active. So mm-hmm. it's going to be a really amazing day on the 26th here in Madtown, USA.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, people, put it in your calendars or in your iPhones. The 26th, Saturday, 12, there's a rally with the Bad River Band, 3 p.m. There's the Warrior Up Indigenous Artists talking and hip-hopping and singing, etc., about deep green resistance. And then at 6, the fundraiser that Thistle was talking about. Anything you want to say to that, Derek?
I want to thank both you and Thistle for your work on it. I think that's really important and great.
Well, thank you. So we have so little time and so much more to talk about. And, Derek, we're going to have you again in a few months.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think we should have you every once in a while. Until we exhaust all of these issues, which might or might not happen. But let's talk then. You've already been asked what can be done, and you've already given your first response to that. But let's go beyond, because we all know that time is very short, and as you mentioned, people can be paralyzed by either the immensity of the situation or the millions of causes they can choose to be involved in, or just the fact that most of us live, most of us who are aware and most of us who are active, live a life that at least to some degree, is a life of hypocrisy. We live in homes, we use electricity, we drive cars, and in this case, I really am talking about we and us and myself. On the other hand, you said that if we plus everybody else have changed our ways, that would make a difference of only 18%, where in fact we need to change everything by 80%. And we all know again that it's late. It's late. Even if the whole world suddenly changed, these 80% won't happen on time, though hopefully they might happen. So where do we go from here? How do we avoid despair, paralysis? What can we do beyond being activists? To what degree do you believe in participating in the political system? Do you believe in militant action? And if so, what does that mean? What do we do?
So you've just basically booked me every week for the next year. Because those are all huge questions. I want to start first with years and years ago, gosh, 20-some years ago, I was talking with an indigenous friend and saying, oh, my gosh, I feel so bad because I drive a car, and I'm responsible for global warming, and it's my fault, and I'm a hypocrite. And the person said to me, Jeanette Armstrong, she's great. She's an Okanagan writer and activist. She said, you didn't create car culture. Don't take responsibility for what's not yours. It's not your fault you participate in the system. What you need to do is to destroy car culture. And it's like another friend of mine, Leah Keith, says that the task of an activist is not, this is the most important thing I'm going to say today, the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down those systems of oppressive authority. And the point is that in the 1980s was the first time that corporate newspapers called human beings consumers more often than it called them human beings. And that's really crucial, because so much of the environmental stuff is, oh, just reduce your personal lifestyle, like the Al Gore stuff. All of it was personal at the end. Food Inc., same way, talking about how horrible the food system is. And at the end, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to buy yogurt from Walmart. It's nuts. And one of the things that does is that convinces us the problem is us. And it puts our focus in the wrong place. It's sort of the same as when people talk about people have a right to clean air, clean water, whatever. I think that's really important for people to have a right to clean air, clean water, but it keeps the focus in the wrong place because the problem is the perpetrators. Instead, I believe we need to take away the rights of those who wish to destroy clean water. No one should have the right to destroy clean water. No one should have the right to pollute water. No one should have the right to destroy someone else's food base. And as opposed to, you know, saying I have the right to food. And I think that's a crucial difference because it puts the attention back where it's supposed to be. Because if you can be convinced that you are a consumer and not a citizen, your range of resistance is much more limited. As a consumer, your choices are buy or not buy. You know, I read something the other day from some member of the environmental intelligentsia saying, you know, we vote with every dollar we spend. I was like, well, those are your options. But as a citizen, you have bigger options. You can vote. You can not vote. You can buy. You can not buy. You can vote. You can not vote. You can organize. You can not organize. You can boycott. You can, when, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you can alter or abolish the government. You can revolt. That's what a citizen can do. A consumer can't do that. And so one of the things we need to do is to break our identity as consumers and remember our identity as citizens. And then we need to make another change, too, which is several thousand years ago, we were converted from being human animals who live in community and require clean air and clean water, who need habitat, and we were converted from that to citizens, where we rely on the state to take care of our problems. We are dependent upon the state, and that's another transformation. We have to remember that we're human animals who have teeth and claws and who will defend our loved ones or defend our family. And so my point is that I want to go back to that line. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible, but rather to take down those systems. And so I live pretty cheaply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate, you know? It's not actually a political statement. And I use pieces of scratch paper until there's nothing left on them, but that's mainly, I think that might be sort of a little bit obsessive compulsive. That's not actually political, because it doesn't matter. And just look at it this way. I wrote this one essay called Forget Shorter Showers, where I said, you know, the world's running out of water. Well, the world isn't actually running out of water. The water's being stolen. And more than 90% of the water is used by agriculture and industry. So if you stop taking showers, all that's going to do is, you know, ruin your social life. It doesn't actually accomplish anything because that's not where the real action is. Municipal humans use the same amount of water as municipal golf courses, for crying out loud. And so municipal golf courses are much greater uses. So I think you'd spend your time much better stopping golf courses than personally taking shorter showers. The same with driving. You'd be much better trying to destroy the entire automobile system than simply, you know, driving less.
Yeah. Well, Derek Jensen, again, I'll be in touch in 3-4 months to continue talking. I have a full page here of questions and notes that I never got to ask you, plus another half page of questions that came up just during our conversation. So hopefully you will agree to join us again.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Great. Thank you so much, Derek Jensen, a prolific author, environmental activist. Thanks for joining us today. And we're going out with the closing song of that same event in Milwaukee earlier this week again, courtesy of Rebecca Campbell, who recorded that and wrote about it. You can find her writing at thepoesive.org and also at the, let's see if I can remember, Wisconsin Citizens Media Corp, WCM Corp, I believe. Just Google her name. Thanks again, Derek.
Okay, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. And thanks to Mark and Lois and Anjali and to you all for listening in. And those who called, I am Esti Dinur. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.